Amen. All right. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Some would say that 1 Samuel chapter 8, and this is kind of a heavy statement, but some would say this is the biggest mistake Israel made in their entire history. Now you think about the different decisions Israel has made in rebellion against God, for example. There's some significant ones. Golden calves, you know, the worship of Molech, their version of abortion and late-term abortion was the worship of Molech. Of course, the rejection of the Messiah, that's pretty significant. There's a lot when you consider Israel's history, and yet many would say this was the worst decision Israel ever made. So, I don't know if I can get on board with that completely, but I just want to let you know there's many that suggest that, okay? Let's dive in and see what that's all about. 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 1 goes like this, "And it came to pass when Samuel was old." You can picture that, right? "Then he made his sons judges over Israel. Now the name of his firstborn was Joel, the name of his second, Abiah. They were judges in Beersheba, and his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after lucre. They took bribes and perverted judgment." Let's pause there. That's something to take on right there. You guys remember 1 Samuel chapter 7 kind of gives us an idea of the life of Samuel. He was an itinerant prophet, right? He was on a 50-mile circuit, faithful, you know, and devoted. And he would return home as he would travel this circuit. But what's he doing? He's judging. He's kind of acting as a discerner to the issues of every community. He's offering sacrifices. He's bringing rebuke often. He's, of course, speaking on behalf of God, very prophetically. And Samuel fulfilled that role of prophet, in fact, the first official prophet of Israel. And I love how 1 Samuel chapter 7 closes out. It really does intrigue me. It says that Samuel served the Lord all the days of his life. And of course, we know that means from a child. When he was weaned from his mother, he was dropped off quite literally at the temple. From that point until he died, he faithfully served the Lord. And I kind of just mentioned in closing last week, that's a rare guy. That's a rare guy that would plant himself in a community and share the word of God and serve God's people for the entirety of his life. There's actually more pastors in our world, in America. They don't stay in the pulpit beyond, you know, 3 to 4 years. That's the burnout average, 3 to 4 years. Done. But Samuel was one of those lifers, man, one of those rare exceptions. Even, and I hope this doesn't sound divisive or weird, but even the concept of retirement in ministry isn't really a biblical idea. But that's because we've made it a career in the States. See, we've put minister kind of on the same level as lawyer or doctor or professor or teacher. And many, many denominations, many pastors have like a retirement package, and they have vacation plans and sick pay, and they'll put in their time, and that's that. And whether you agree or disagree with that, I certainly understand maybe there's a point where a man's, you know, intellectual decline is such that he's not effective anymore. I get that. But what you do see in the scriptures is God calling somebody, and that call does not lift until they die. You know, until they die. Samuel fulfilled that. It's really, to me, inspirational that a man would give his life, the whole of it, to the service of the Lord. That means a lot. It means a lot. Well, having said that, there's no chapter 8 in this. It goes on right from there, talking about how he just was faithful all of his life. It goes on to talk about Samuel being old. And then as he is old, he's involving his sons in ministry, like any good dad would want to do, right? Specifically a dad in ministry. He wants to see the torch pass. He wants to see the young guys take the torch and continue. He wants to see the work of the Lord. It's not all about him, see. He wants to see that go beyond. We have the names, Joel and Abiah, but this is the tragic part. As he kind of put these two young men in Sheba, you know, basically gave them a level of responsibility, it tells us in verse 3, tragically, his sons walked not in his ways, but turned aside after money. Money. That's what got them. There's a lot of speculation there, but you know, let's just be practical for a moment, okay? You got a young man, Samuel, who has been in ministry his entire life, literally since he was a weaned child. And this man has never had really the opportunity to go out there and earn a bunch of money and start a career. He's never had the opportunity to store up. He's just lived as a slave. That's what minister means, after all. He's just there available to serve people. And when you're serving people, especially like Samuel, on a national level, there's never a lack of need, right? Never a lack of need. So I think it's safe to say Samuel lived a very modest life at best. This isn't a very wealthy man. No doubt Samuel grew up, or the sons of Samuel grew up seeing wealthy Jewish men and very, you know, prominent families. And yet, you know, our dad's in ministry, right? Our dad just travels and he receives, you know, out of the goodness of people's heart. But he's kind of given his life up on all this stuff. It's interesting that as these young men got older, they're like, not us. We're going after some money, you know. And it's interesting, maybe these sons grew up bitter. Maybe they grew up a little sour. Maybe they grew up looking over the fence and going, man, look at the fun they're having over there. And that can happen in a ministry home. It can. And you know, the more you see toys and fun and excitement all around you, the easier that can happen, actually. That's why covetousness is such a deadly thing in the scriptures. Well, Samuel's sons, they got into a position of influence, and they used their position to become financially, you know, successful, financially stable, received money for bribes. Now, you know, there's no New Testament rebuke. There's no Old Testament. God doesn't climb all over Samuel like he does Eli. I want you to know that. He rebukes Eli. You have allowed your sons to exist in a sinful state. There just isn't that in there. That's what you do here is commendation. And it's just this, guys. There's two kinds of rebellious sons, okay? There are sons that are rebellious because of a horrible example that was set in their home. That they're doing what they've seen done, right? And they've kind of been raised by wolves, as we say, and discipled to be sex addicts and thieves and disrespectful and, you know, whatever. You know, scoff at authority. They've been raised that way. But then the other rebellious person you see in the scriptures is what the scriptures refer to as a prodigal. What does it mean that they're prodigal? They're leaving the way they've been raised. They're walking. They're looking right at their father who did set a good example, and they're choosing to reject it and go after the filth of this world. God the Father has prodigals. If you read the parable there, we hear about a man with two sons. And, of course, the father is a picture of God in that parable, right? Very clearly. So even the perfect heavenly father, we can't blame God for poor parenting or neglect or anything like that. Even a perfect dad like God has prodigals, right? I've been that. I've been that. I've been a wayward son, and I have zero excuse to be so. I knew better. I was raised in church. I decided to spit on all of it and do my own thing for a season. So we see failure in the sons of Samuel, but what we don't see is God rebuking Samuel. There's a lot there to think about, for sure. A lot there to apply, potentially. But what the failure of the sons of Samuel does provide, and what failure in church leadership does provide, guess what? It provides excuses for people to live self-indulgently and according to their flesh. Now, I would never ask you to raise your hand, but I just know, because it's the world we live in, there are, maybe most of us in this room have experienced failure in church leadership. I know I grew up seeing failure in pastors and leaders and elders and deacons. I was aware growing up of so many scandalous things in church, and that probably did contribute to why I at least felt justified in walking away from God and in the church and this and that. You know, that's such a common thing in America, guys. It's we've created a coined phrase. It's called church hurt. I suffer from church hurt. That's a thing, and it really is a thing. We've all seen it. So let's just keep that in mind as we serve the Lord. We try to provide an example. We certainly want to, like the Apostle Paul, say, follow me as I follow Christ. All the while realizing in our failure, we do give ammo, don't we, to the flesh. Like it was said of David, you have given the enemies of Christ, or you've given the enemies of God an opportunity to blaspheme his name. It's his reputation that ultimately suffers. But dig deep for just a moment. Again, I won't ask you to raise your hand, but dig deep for just a moment. Think about some of the darkest chapters in your life. And surely you, like me, have thought, well, my pastor did it. Or this godly man failed, and surely it can't be so bad. Surely God could overlook my sin, and he's continued to bless him, and his new marriage is good. You know what I mean? And we have all these kind of less than ideal examples in our life, and we can easily springboard off them and excuse our flesh. But I want to say again, church, just because man misrepresents God, that does not change who God is. That's something that God brought me to as a young man that I just had to settle, really. Had to settle. And also remember this, the mercy of God, the fact that he isn't judging you immediately for your sin or mine. The mercy of God is never to be misinterpreted as the tolerance of God, and it often is, right? No lightning crack. Hey, things are still happening. God's even continuing to bless the ministry. Do not confuse the mercy of God as his tolerance towards sin. He doesn't tolerate sin. He's holy, he's just. Always and only and forever, he's holy and just. It's important for us to remember these things. So, here we go. Here's how it's used against him. It says, the elders in verse 4 of Israel gathered themselves together. They came to Samuel, unto Ramah, and they said unto him, behold, thou art old, and your sons walk not in your ways. Now, make us a king to judge us like all the nations. You see that? I strongly suspect they don't actually care about the sons of Samuel. I strongly suspect they don't actually care that these guys are making a few bucks and getting paid to exonerate or expunge the bad guys of Israel. I strongly suspect they don't really care. Because they're not dealing with this issue. They're not saying, we demand something be done. These men are unjust. They're saying, no, we just want to reject God. We're tired of the whole system. Give us a king like all the other nations. You see that? So they're using the failure of these boys as an excuse to go off and reject God in their own life. That's shallow. That's not commendable. That's not respectable. That's pretty see-through, actually. You would agree? And yet, it happens all the time. Happens all the time. So remember that failure provides an excuse. And now, this is what I meant by Israel's biggest mistake. This is when Israel officially turns their eyes from God and what he had established there in Israel, which has been known kind of formally as a theocracy. This is when they've rejected that officially and they've requested a human king, a monarchy, and they're reason for selecting this is we want to look identical to the world around us. So much that's tragic about that. First of all, you guys know God established a system that we call a theocracy where he would directly rule and lead Israel. It was perfect, right? There would be no problems governmentally. You have, and by the way, you have the one and only case in all of human history, a very efficient and compassionate government all at the same time, because God is the only benevolent dictator. A dictatorship is extremely efficient. You would agree with that? I realize we would never submit to that or be excited about a dictatorship, because humans are corrupt and humans are selfish, and with a little bit of power, you become more so, and with absolute power, of course, there's absolute corruption, right? So a dictatorship is really, really bad on a human level. But what if you do have the one and only dictator who speaks and the world bows to what he says? It's efficient, it's quick, no committees. Imagine it. Things get done quickly, swift justice, swift needs being met. Imagine a dictator who is morally absolute and morally perfect and holy and just. A benevolent dictatorship would be the best government the world has ever seen. And by the way, that is the government coming to this world on the heels of the second coming of Christ. The millennial kingdom will be the first and only, you know, established, you know, benevolent dictatorship. All right, there's that. Israel is rejecting all of that, and they want a monarchy. They want a human king that can be on their front page articles. They want a human king that will lead them into battle. They want a human king so they can, as they interact with the world around them, have that in common. See, you know, excuse the illustration, but it's like a homeschool kid. You know, Israel was like a homeschool kid in this context. And as they're, you know, buying groceries at the Gentile Hannaford, and they're up and down the hallways, you know, the grocery aisles, you know, the worldly kids are like, where do you go to school? No, I'm a dropout. I don't go to school. I'm too cool for that, or whatever. You know, Israel was self-conscious because they were very different in that sense. They didn't have a king. They didn't have a military like that. They didn't have what the world had and prided themselves in. And that was probably their biggest problem. You hear that, mom and dad? You tell your kid, no, not here. We're not doing that. I don't care if little Joey and little Susie has a phone and they're six. You're not getting one, dude. No phone. Until you have your own job and your own paycheck, you're not going to have a phone in our house. And guess what comes back? Well, so-and-so does. And they'll mention some of you elders' kids. I love causing problems. It's my hobby. You know, but they will. They'll mention other good Christian families with kids that are 7 or 8 or 9 and have phones. We want to be like everybody else, essentially, is what your children say. But of course, you parents are stronger than that, right? You see through that. You're like, punk. If Joey jumped off a bridge, you know what I mean? You know, we have our godly adult comebacks. But that's essentially what these grown people are saying. We want a king like everybody else. And what an offensive thing, man. What an offensive thing that is to God. They were supposed to be unique. And here's something, we'll leave this point. But Israel was supposed to be, and I quote, a holy nation. That's a nation set apart. That's a nation deliberately different. Hey, you Christians in the room, are you okay with that this evening? Are you okay with living in a world where you seek to be deliberately different than this world? I'm not supposed to think like you. I'm not supposed to operate like you. I'm not supposed to have the same goals and drives and priorities. That's the church, guys. We are the ecclesia, the called out ones. The world operates like this. God is calling us out to be deliberately different. That's what the term holy means. That's what it means when we are referred to in the New Testament as a peculiar people. They have no idea. They should come to MCF. We'll prove that. We are peculiar. The most. But are you cool with that? Are you okay with being different? Because guess what? As the world changes dramatically, you're becoming more and more so. The way you think, what you value is becoming so very different than the norm around you. You okay with that? I think probably I know who I'm talking to. You got to be okay with that to survive in our world for sure. All right. Verse 6, it says, the thing, that's this request for a king. This thing displeased Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed unto the Lord. And the Lord said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people in all that they say unto thee, for they have not rejected thee, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. Boy, there's a lot here, guys. First of all, the fact that this bothered Samuel, that says a lot about his character. Samuel was a man who understands God's will. He understands the condition and the heart condition of the people that he serves. And he understands the ramifications and the long term based on what these people are requesting. I just love that about Samuel. He's not a frivolous guy. He's not random in his thoughts. He's a thoughtful, wise, discerning man. And when they're saying, we want a king, he instantly knows, oh my goodness, that would be the beginning of the end. And then beyond that, this description of him being displeased, it's very clear, as God speaks, Samuel was taking this extremely personal. extremely personal. That's part of why Samuel was really bummed out by this. Now, we could critique that too, couldn't we? We could critique it. We could find flaw and fault in all of that. But let's just think realistically. And that's kind of what this church is about, right? We like being real. And we like just saying it how it is. And the truth is, this man has given his entire life to the nation of Israel. He's served it faithfully. Since he was a kid, since he's had conscious thought, he has served the people of Israel. So there's a pretty significant time investment. And no doubt he has wept and prayed and cried and spoke, you know, all these things. So the fact that Samuel is taking this rejection somewhat personally, we could critique that, but at the same time, you can kind of understand it too, right? Like, man, all that I've spoken, all that I've said, all that I've tried to model, and they want nothing to do with any of it. And he's in a pity party, and that's certainly recognizable in all this. But I think to some degree, I get it. You know what I mean? Don't you? Don't you get it? But what I love about Samuel is, as he's taking this personal, he isn't attacking the people. He takes it to the Lord. That shows some wisdom, man. He's hurt. I mean, let's just say it how it is. Samuel's hurt in that request. And he's really kind of shook by this whole thing. But I love how it says Samuel prayed unto the Lord. He took this insecurity, he took this personal offense, and he went right to the Lord with it. And the Lord ministers to Samuel and gives him a very different perspective, gives him his directive, and that's how prayer is supposed to work, by the way. You know, if your prayer life is such where you go before the Lord with your complaints and your concerns, and you leave your time of prayer more frazzled and more complaining, just so we know, whether you're complaining in prayer or complaining with other humans, complaining just makes us more frazzled and bitter, and we're more likely to complain. But what's the purpose of prayer, guys? What's the purpose of prayer? Is it to manipulate God? Is it to exercise our faith in that God is now obligated because our faith is authentic? There's a lot of weird ideas about prayer. Prayer is to determine and establish the will of God, actually. It really is. Jesus modeled that. Here's my concern. Here's my request. If there's any other way, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not my will. Do not give me what I want. Who prays like that anymore? What you hear in the faith community, and even in some good people, we have this emphasis on prayer always. This is what I want to happen. And with real fervent prayer, God is kind of obligated to do it. And actually, what you see in the scriptures is people saying, all right, God, here's the deal. What do you want to do in this situation? What do you want to do in this situation, God? I'm laying this out before you. And then to listen to God and say, your will be done. Not mine, your will be done. That's biblical prayer. And I see that with Samuel. Samuel is not saying, God, you change their mind right now. This is bad. He's saying, all right, this is really killing me, God. This is killing me. Minister to me. Show me what I'm missing. How do you want me to respond? And God says, all right, you ready for this? Give it to him. That was probably the last thing Samuel wanted to hear. What? That's exactly right. You go back there and you give them exactly what you and I know is going to destroy this nation. You give it to him, Samuel. That's prayer, guys. And when we go into prayer, we really seek the Lord, we usually, and I believe biblically, should come out with a very different, at least clearer, and sometimes very opposite perspective as when we went in. That's when you know your prayer time was very effective. And you wrestle with God. What did Jacob, he wrestled with God, wrestled with him. And God won. God won. We've made prayer. We wrestle with God and we win. And God says, all right, you can have it. Because you really prayed hard this time and you didn't even eat anything. Do you see what I'm saying? Find that emphasis, guys. Find it in the scriptures. This manipulation thing. It's just kind of absent. So determining the will of God, I believe, is the objective of prayer. And his will is perfect. His will is right. He sees things that we don't see. His ways are higher, see. So again, God ministers to Samuel's heart, no doubt, by saying, listen to their voice. That part was hard to swallow. Give them what they want. And by the way, they haven't rejected you, Samuel. They've rejected me. That's a trade secret, isn't it, church? Guys, you share the gospel with somebody, and they say, get out of my face with your Jesus. Don't ever come back here. Guess what? They actually didn't reject you. They rejected the Jesus you were presenting. If you see yourself as that, it's kind of a humble perspective, isn't it? If you don't take yourself too serious and you just see yourself as a bread distributor, I'm just a messenger. By the way, if you see yourself as just a messenger, you can walk up to any mic in front of any group of people because it isn't about you. And I really do believe timidity is a self-centeredness. I minister to people that I love very much in my own family with this. To be timid and to not dare to speak into a microphone really comes down to you actually, as much as I love you, think more about yourself than you ought to. This isn't about you. This is about the cause. This is about God's work. This is about saying what needs to be said. And you'll actually find in your life a great level of boldness when you can just work through all of that. It isn't about how I talk, how I look, how I dress, if there's a shake in my voice. It's not about any of that. We are simply, brothers and sisters, bread distributors. Jesus takes the bread, he blessed it, he broke it, he distributed it to the disciples. The disciples took what they received from Jesus and they delivered it to the multitude. That's ministry. That's it. This bread came from Jesus. Either eat it or leave it. But here it is, you know? And that's our role. That's our role here. And Samuel really needed to hear that. He needed to hear, man, Samuel, it's not about you, buddy. They've rejected me. So, give them. Give them the king. Verse 8, according to all the works which they have done, this is the context of them rejecting that God would reign over them. He goes on to say, according to all the works which they have done, since the day that I brought them up out of Egypt, even unto this day, wherewith they have forsaken me and served other gods, so do they also unto thee. What is God saying? Samuel, you think this is hard for you. This is all I've ever known with this group of people. Think about that. Oh, this is hard for you to swallow, Sam. This is hard for you to go to bed at night. You feel burdened. You feel shook by this. Well, just so you know, as soon as I stepped into this people we call Israel's lives, rescued them from Egypt valiantly, you know, miraculously, as soon as I involved myself with these people, I have been rejected from day one to the present. They have never wanted what I have to offer. But what I've known of the people of Israel is one rejection after another, one defiant act after another. That helps too, really. If I ever get in that woe is me mode, and I do, by the way, I get in that mode. I'm human. There's times when things happen in our church or we have failure in our leadership, tragically. There's times where I can go in a really, really weird, dark place. Like, what's going on, man? And when I do that, if I'm honest, I'm thinking too highly of me. I'm thinking, man, my sermons are better than that. How can we have this level of sin? And God will adjust me really quickly. I'm like, what? What in the world have you ever taught? What in the world have you ever said that generations of pastors haven't said before you, Aaron? Not to mention they have my word themselves. And I'll have to say, oh, Lord, I'm so sorry. Yeah, I just got a little self-centered there for a minute. Please, oh, God, forgive me. He's faithful to do it, church. He really is faithful to put me in my place, believe me. But, man, we can get thinking selfishly often. But when I do that, God reminds me, you know, you've lived on this earth for 44 years. What do you think I've watched from my heavenly perspective for 7,000 years, nearly? What do you think I've been watching in the human race? Man, I've seen every vile act from Adam and Eve to the present. It's kind of what he's saying here to Samuel. Get over it, bud. It gets worse when you become me. You know what I mean? It's like complaining around a real old person about your aches and pains. Boy, they have zero patience for that, right? Zero patience, rightfully so. here's God's advice. He says this in verse 9, now therefore, hearken unto their voice. Howbeit, yet protest solemnly unto them, and show them the manner of the king that shall reign over them. Samuel, I want you to give them exactly what they're asking. Now, that's one thing to talk about very briefly. Often God will do that, right? Often God disciplines his children by giving his children exactly what they had to have and wouldn't be happy without, even though it's completely contrary to the will of his word, the revealed will in his word. I gotta have him, God. Well, he's not saved. He's not even close to saved. And you're going to raise your kids, and there's going to be a horrible war and conflict. This is a bad scene from the beginning. But I have to have him, God. I can't be happy without him. And God will and has, right? All right. All right. He's yours. I mean, a month and a half after the honeymoon. Oh, God, take him back. God, please take him back. Oh, no. No, you had to, right? You wouldn't listen to anyone. You wouldn't listen to reason. You wouldn't listen to sound counsel. You had to have him. I know, but oh, God, I didn't know him. Exactly. You know, and that's often how God works, truthfully. In many areas of our life, church, often God gives us the very thing we need to show us, I didn't need that, nor do I want one more taste of it, truthfully. One more taste of it. Remember when Israel wanted flesh? They were really sick of the manna. Oh, man, if I have one more bite of manna, I'm going to, what? It was like superfood and stuff. You actually would be just fine with the manna. If you don't want manna, get your act together and get in the promised land, you dum-dums. Quit wandering around and trust the Lord. That's how you get out of the manna boat. But they wanted to wander around, so they had to have quail. God, you want quail. Remember what the scriptures say? He causes this big wind to kick up and just drive thousands and potentially millions of birds. They just collide with the beach. They had so much quail. Let's just partridge, right? It was coming out their noses. Seriously, that's what the scripture, they filled their gut so much, they're just having some pretty serious, you know, GERD. And they got quail snot. And it's bad. It's concerning. What is God saying? How's your quail? I'm just asking, sincerely, how is your quail? And the children of Israel are like, please, please, never again. Oh, man, we could go on and on how we see a pattern of God disciplining us with giving us the very thing we needed. But it comes with a warning. God doesn't just give us this without stating for the record, okay, here he is, here's your king, but I want you to know very clearly why I tried to keep you from this. If you want a king, here's what kings come with. And here's a list, guys, and this should be an all too familiar list for us, right? Here we go. Tells us let's pick up in verse 11. He said, this will be the manner of the king that shall reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for himself, for his chariots, and to be his horsemen. And some shall run before his chariots, and he will appoint him captains over thousands and captains over fifties. He will set them to ear his ground and to reap his harvest and to make his instruments of war and instruments of his chariots. Well, first thing you should know, as you receive this king that you're about to get, your sons are going to be drafted, taken from your homes, used in his military, used to make things for him, weaponry, used to tend his fields. You're going to lose your sons, and they're not going to be available for you. They are going to be slaves of this king. You're going to lose your children to this new way of life. That's the first thing you ought to know. There's consequences, see, to disobeying God. All right, so there's that. They had to think about that. They had to swallow that. Verse 13, he'll take your daughters too to be confectionaries and to be cooks and bakers. He's going to steal your daughters and they're going to move into his palace and they're going to make food for him, for the king's menu. And he'll take your fields. You're going to lose your properties to this king. There are heavy taxes to support this king that you want, just like all the other nations, remember? You want to be just like them? Well, all this comes with it, guys. He's going to take your fields, he's going to take your vineyards, he's going to take your olive yards, even the best of them, and give them to his servants. That's the way that works. And he will take the tenth of your seed. This is a tithe. It is absolutely a tax. Keep that in mind as we transition into the New Testament. Of your vineyards, and he'll give to his officers and to his servants. He'll take your men servants and your maid servants, your goodliest young men, your donkeys, and he'll put them to his work. He will take the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants, is the English rendering, but it's slaves. You want this king, but I just want you to know you will, in this process, become enslaved to this monarchy. He's going to own you. The idea is God wasn't interested in any of that. He's like, you know, this is the idea of an unalienable right we call liberty. God said, I want you to have all of that. I want you to have your possessions. I want you to have your properties. I want you to manage them. I want you to raise your own children. I want your children to be available for your family. God said, that was my plan. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it, guys? I want you to be able to take your own shovels and your own dirt and your own resources and invest them into your property and yield something that your family can benefit from. That was God's will. Let's not be confused about that. Really. In fact, why is taking property wrong? Because God established a law, guys. Thou shalt not steal. In other words, when you understand the Ten Commandments, that's your wife. Don't covet somebody else's wife. That's your property. Do not steal. Don't covet what somebody else. So much of the Ten Commandments has to do with personal ownership and personal property. That meant something to God. That's in his code, see. But boy, all of that, because we're not allowed to even post the Ten Commandments publicly anymore. Not even allowed to post it. Why? Because it screams the truth about what God intended for a people and his standard. And God is reminding the nation of Israel, you're rejecting me and my beautiful, balanced way of life. And the benevolence and the year of Jubilee, in God's economy, every 50th year, everybody goes debt-free. Every slave goes back to his family. You have this king involved. Good luck with that, God says. Good luck with that. You will be enslaved throughout the duration of this monarchy. So, consequences to rejecting God is what's being described here. Oh, there's so much I'm tempted to talk about with that, but I think you guys can make some pretty obvious application in our own life. He's going to take, in verse 17, the tenth of your sheep, and you shall be his servants. In verse 18, and you shall cry out in that day because of your king, which you shall have chosen you, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. There's no going back on this, Israel. If you want a king, fair enough. I'm out. But this is what comes with it. And I'm telling you, in the midst of all this, you're going to come crying to me. And I'm just telling you right now, make your decision right now, because I'm not going to listen at that point. That's God playing tough love, right? You need to embrace this decision. You know, I'll be honest with you, and I'm almost done, but I fear we're there, guys. I fear we're there as a nation. That we've made some decisions, and I hate to even say it out loud, but at this point, there's no going back on many of them. You know what I mean? There's just been too much erosion, and the ball has just been rolling down this hill too long. And what we're dealing with now is just the kind of the final fallout. And I hope that doesn't sound pessimistic. I'd like to think it's just realistic. But I'm telling you, I fear that. I fear that our nation is moving in that direction if it isn't already there. We've lost some significant ground, and many of us are crying out to God. But here he says, right here, again, just to make my emphasis on prayer, you're going to cry out to me, and I'm not going to listen. What does that say? God's will is superior to our will, even in the context of prayer, right? I'm not going to listen. He's saying it in advance. Because his will, ultimately, is the important thing, even in prayer. Nevertheless, the people refuse to obey the voice of Samuel, right? Because he's a negative preacher type. Always has a bad message. That's, oh my word, taxes, take our daughters. This guy, what a conspiracy theorist this Samuel is, right? Give me a break. And they don't want anything to do with what Samuel is. Guys, listen to me. This is what's going to happen if we go this direction. And they're yawning, and they're going, oh my, this guy is so old, and he's so out of it. And they just say, okay, thanks. Thanks for the warning, Samuel. Where's our king? Can we please have our king now? They say, no, but we will have a king over us. That we also may be, and here it is again, like all the nations with all their venereal diseases and all their crime rates and all their, you know, kids born out of wedlock and all their horrible disasters and diseases. And we want to be just like all the other nations, and that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. What's funny, one of the first main battles you see King Saul, and he's hiding from Goliath. Isn't that comical? Whoa, what happened to that? He's terrified. Actually, we'll get to that in just a moment, but not tonight. Samuel heard all the words of the Lord, and he rehearsed them in the ears of the Lord. Once again, he heard all this, and he took it to the Lord. Didn't snap. Convicting, really. And the Lord said to Samuel, hearken unto their voice, and make them a king. And Samuel said unto the men of Israel, go ye every man unto his city. We'll regather here in a week or so, and we'll see the introduction to the first king of Israel, Saul of Kish. And there's a lot interesting about this king. That's as far as we'll get this evening, guys. That's 1 Samuel chapter 8.